coming to you since 1997 on KKUP Radio with over 250 guests and still going strong in their 12th year of weekly broadcasting, the International Taz and Paula Show brings to you expansive, engaging, and groundbreaking intensity on radio and now on the internet airwaves today. Listen live every Thursday or visit Embracing Mother Earth's archives, exclusive articles, ask questions, and receive actual answers from guests anytime at TazandPaulaShow.com. Taz and Paula's special guests are experts coming from all walks of life, energizing our lives with a passion that inspires and teaches us with each of their compelling personal life journeys, with roots from ancient wisdom and bridging it with modern science. We hope today's show touches the wisdom of your heart. And now, Taz and Paula.
Good morning. This is Paula Nunes.
And good morning. This is Taz Powers.
Well, we have another incredible guest today. We have Wendy Craig Purcell. She is the founder of the minister of the Unity Center in San Diego. And on September 1st of this year, Wendy's first book, Ask Yourself, came out. And actually the full title is Ask Yourself This, Questions to Open the Heart, Expand the Mind, and Waken the Soul. She has been observing that today's world events are prompting people to reevaluate what's important in life, who they are, who they want to be, and while self-exploration comes easily to some, it can be an intimidating endeavor for those less naturally to be introspective. Either way, in Ask Yourself This, Wendy reveals the startling insight that the right questions asked at the right time can be even more powerful than answers. She notes questions are like channels through which our mental, emotional, and creative energy flows. Asking good questions is the doorway to personal transformation. Welcome, Wendy.
I'm happy to be with you. Good morning.
Well,
good morning. It looks like you ask good questions.
I try to.
Oh, I think you do. Paula said that she saw a clip of you interviewing Deepak Chopra about the third Jesus. My goodness, what inspired you to ask that question?
No, that's incredible. It was a web series with Deepak.
It was, and then it's actually being shown on PBS in various markets throughout the country. That was a deep experience of asking questions, to be sure.
Oh, I bet. And you must have felt so honored to be able to do this.
Absolutely. I have studied Deepak for many, many years. In fact, he was a guest speaker in my ministry probably 25 years ago before he really became so very well known. I think it was right after the release of his book, Perfect Health.
Mm. Well, to get back to your book, which is incredible, what led you to write Ask Yourself This?
Well, you know, I really do think that we're living in extraordinary times right now, and that the circumstances that so many of us are facing are really requiring that we deeply rethink many aspects of our lives, from our spirituality, our sense of purpose, to our careers and our relationships. You know, I think people are really needing and wanting much better answers that can meet the challenges that we're facing individually and collectively in our world. And what I know from almost 30 years now in the field of spirituality and consciousness work is that to get better answers, we've got to ask better questions and oftentimes bigger questions, and sometimes we have to ask a completely different question. So I think that this is a pathway not only to personal transformation, but can be a pathway to global transformation as well.
What possessed you to birth this book? Was there any particular aspect that happened in your life that brought this forth?
Very good question. Actually, I have always been prompted by deep questioning. I'm a very self-reflective person. I grew up in a family dynamic where it wasn't enough just to try to get the right answers, for example, on a test. It was very important to my parents, my father in particular, that in our growing up, that we learned how to think deeply, creatively, and broadly. And that's really a very fertile ground, if you will, for the idea of self-reflective questions. So it was, I think, actually something very natural that came out of both my upbringing, but then also the work that I've been doing in the field of consciousness and spirituality for a lot of years, realizing that people get on one train of thinking, one train of acting, one train of behaving, and often that's because we're so focused on trying to solve a problem and get our answers that we haven't stopped to step back long enough to ask ourselves, am I really asking the kinds of questions that will open my mind and open my heart and my soul to bigger, broader, better, and newer answers?
Well, that was incredible that your father taught you that. It would be so worth children to learn that now. I mean, they're so, like, things are fed to them, given to them through TV, through media, and they don't, and even adults, we don't
right.
step back and ask questions.
Right. You know, we're taught to get the right answer in school to be able to pass the test, and we even teach to the test. And while there's certainly some validity to that, if that's the only or primary approach we take to education, then we're really shortchanging ourselves, because there's so much more than just getting the one-time right answer. If we haven't trained our children or haven't learned ourselves how to think creatively, it's going to be very difficult for us to figure out how to solve the very real day-to-day challenges that every single one of us faces, regardless of the huge challenges we're facing as a society today.
Now, how to ask yourself, how is this? I mean, there's so many books out right now because of to improve our consciousness. And how is your book different? I think you've answered part of this, but how is it different than other books that are out?
Well, I think one of the ways that it's different is that most books give you answers, and this one really gives you questions and a framework for how to approach various aspects of your life through asking some very broad self-reflective, and some of them are very fun questions. And it's also, I think, a very portable book. Not only is it relatively short, it is portable in that it's not requiring you so much to learn somebody else's information as it is suggesting that you really have some incredibly rich answers within you that you may not be able to tap into because you're dancing around them. You're not asking the kinds of questions that are going to probe that deep inner innate wisdom that really resides within every one of us. You know, the word education has its roots in the Greek word educare. And educare means to pull from within out. Originally, the concept of education was that the student had tremendous wisdom and insight already, and that the process of education was not so much to look at the mind or the student as a blank slate and writing upon that blank slate, but that it was much more the idea of pulling out from within the innate wisdom.
It's not. It's the capability of not shortchanging yourself with a growth of to think.
Right.
Yeah.
That was during the time there were so many philosophers, when I think people were taught to do this, and we lost it along the way.
Right. You know, certainly there's information that we need to learn, skills that we need to learn, things that are not innate within us. But, you know, most of the challenges we have in life are the kinds of things that can only be solved through wisdom, not so much through intelligence, but through wisdom. And that's part of what happens in the Socratic method, if you will, of learning. It's about tapping into that inner wisdom.
Have you gotten any feedback from people that have used your book as a tool?
I have. And, you know, people are enjoying the questions. It's interesting to hear the variety of approaches people are taking to using the book, and it's interesting to hear the different kinds of questions that people respond to. The book is divided into 7 chapters with a bonus chapter, and the main part of the book, the first 7 chapters, really is looking at questions across 7 very distinct areas of life and living. And I've started to have people, even though the book's only been out a short time, say to me that they've used a particular question and it caused them to think a totally different answer or to get their answer very clearly and very quickly because they asked a particular question. So it's really becoming very rewarding to hear how people are benefiting from the book. And really what they're benefiting from is what they're tapping into that's already inside of them. The questions are just a vehicle to pull that out.
Do you find that the people using your book are also helping themselves to look at their children in different ways and to teach them in different ways?
I certainly hope so. As I said, the book hasn't been out that long yet, so I haven't heard a whole lot of stories yet about how they're working with the book, with their children. The very last chapter of the book that is kind of a bonus chapter is specifically how I use some of these questions or the idea of questions with my children as they were growing up. And I purposely added that chapter, even though it's very different from the others. It's more personal and it's not questions that you're asking yourself. It's questions I suggest you ask your children. I specifically included that chapter because as a conscious parent, I wanted to help other parents have something simple that they could do with their children every night, and that would not only help their children to grow and expand, but would also help parents feel closer to their children in the most meaningful kinds of ways.
Now, is this a type of book that you would carry along with you as you travel? And
you certainly could, because it's not the size of War and Peace. It's a relatively short book, but even though it's short, the depth of it, if you actually take the questions in, there's a lot to uncover within yourself. So it's certainly portable in that sense. The publisher, Unity House, is working with Amazon right now to make a Kindle version available, so that will certainly make it portable. And then I've also recorded the audio tracks, so sometime soon we'll have it available on CD and as a downloadable podcast. People can go to my website now if they want to, and they can pull off free the introduction and the first chapter of the book to get a flavor of it.
And your website address is?
www.wendycraigpurcell.com.
We will give that out a couple times during this interview so people can write it down. And we'll also have it on our website. You've been a Unity minister for about nearly 3 decades, yet you write in the book that you are spiritual but not religious. What do you mean by this?
You know, yeah, I share a little bit in the book. I think it's in the first chapter. The experiences that would often happen to me as I would be traveling frequently on a plane. And, you know, when you sit down and you take your seat, if you're traveling alone, usually the person next to you will open up a conversation or you'll open up a conversation with them. And it's usually a very surface kind of conversation that begins with, you know, where are you going, and are you going home, or are you traveling away? And then it's usually followed by, and what do you do? And over the years, I've just heard so many different responses and seen so many different looks on people's faces when I've answered the question, I'm a minister. People don't quite know what to do with that, especially in the early years, because most ministers then certainly were not female and were not as young as I was. And I would get a whole series of responses and really excuses oftentimes as to why that particular person no longer went to church, or the God that they didn't believe in God. And it was a very interesting, fruitful kinds of conversations. And I would often ask the person that would say to me, well, I don't believe in God. I'd say, you know, well, tell me about the God you don't believe in. And it was a very surprising question for them. And then they'd start to tell me about the God they don't believe in. And I'd say, you know what? I don't believe in that God either. And quite honestly, I'd say, I am not religious, even though my title would lead you to believe I am, but I am deeply spiritual. And here's what I think the difference is. Religion tends to focus more on beliefs and doctrines and outer practices, usually established by an authority, that usually wind up dividing us. Whereas spirituality focuses more on the inner contemplative life and the transformative practices which ultimately tend to unite us with one another regardless of our so-called beliefs. One is often exclusive. Religion tends to be exclusive, and it tends to be very narrow. The other is inclusive and very broad, and that would be spirituality. You know, I'd say that religion is really more about doing and believing according to someone else's rules, whereas spirituality is about a quality of being, a quality of being in the world that's anchored in wisdom and compassion and deep appreciation, that we're part of a whole and we're part of something that transcends but includes all of us.
I don't know if this is, I feel as though I'm observing that more people are going back to religion right at this time. I don't know if it's because of the world situation. So the Unity Church or your belief would be so easy for people to grasp. Does that make sense? I'm not even asking a question, but I'm just observing that this would be much easier for us to grasp than to... If you've been out of religion for a long time and you feel as though you need something right now.
Right. Yes, I think your observation is correct in that people are looking for answers. They're looking for some reassurance and some comfort. And I think that that people are less likely to go back to their religions of origin unless those religions serve them well. And I think by and large, many people are feeling today that those religions that they grew up in are too confining mentally, emotionally, and socially for them. You know, the world has changed dramatically in so many ways in just the last 10 years, let alone the last 20 or 30. I grew up in the Lutheran Church, so I have a very traditional Protestant background. My parents were not particularly religious per se, but we did go to church and we did participate in the activities there. We were even then very open-minded to other people's faiths. But as much good as I think the traditional church has done in the past, I think traditional church and religion for that matter has also done a lot of harm. And so many people are, just as you say, they're looking for something, and it's a spiritual fulfillment that I think people are hungering, just as we have physical needs and emotional needs and mental needs and social needs. We also have spiritual needs. Sometimes those spiritual needs can be met and fed in traditional religion, but I think more and more today people are finding that their traditional upbringing doesn't serve them anymore. And so, yes, they are gravitating toward approaches such as Unity or religious science or science of the mind that are more open, more inclusive, that honor one's intelligence, that don't believe that they are the only way, that draw upon the perennial wisdom of all the world's religious traditions. That's what people are looking for.
And a sense of community. I think that's very important.
Yeah. You touched upon something really important there. For many years, I would have identified myself as very much an individualist and able to do a lot of things on my own. And yet what I've come to deeply appreciate is that there are certain things you cannot do alone. There are certain needs and certain opportunities to give that can only be met in community. And I think that the answer for so many people today is a two-pronged answer. To find a spiritual path that makes sense to their mind and their heart, whatever that may be, and to find a spiritual community that they feel they can at home in, that they can connect with. And whatever that is, whether it's going back to their Catholic church, going to synagogue, exploring unity, or exploring something completely different, once they find that spiritual teaching or path that makes sense through their mind and heart and a spiritual community to connect with, to stay there then and to work the program, so to speak, is what will give them that sense of growth, that sense of wholeness, that sense of well-being that I think we're all craving, especially during these changing times.
It's like an extended family. I find that a lot of people are talking that they want to go to church because they need an extended family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're very right.
Yeah.
Because at this time, I think a lot of people feel as though there's an empty spot or something lacking and they can't quite put their finger on it.
Right. And I would say it's the God spot. And yet, even as a minister or a spiritual leader, I hesitate to use the word God because people have all different understandings of what that means. But what so many have done is they've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. They've thrown God out or spirituality out because they had less than satisfying experiences in their faith communities that they grew up in. And rather than saying, okay, well, that approach didn't work or that tradition no longer fits me, let me explore something else, they've tended to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think until that spiritual peace or that God peace is satisfied within a person, there's always a hungering and a looking for something more. And yet the reality is that something more cannot be filled by another person or another success or a newer car or a better job. Those things are on the periphery of one's life, as important as some of them may be. At the very core is this need to feel connected with something that is both immanent and transcendent and beyond us and yet a part of us.
Now, what led you to Unity? Because you were very young when you became a minister.
Yeah. I found Unity through my grandmother when I was about 18, actually. And I had stopped going to church after I was confirmed, even though I had a lovely church we participated in and I didn't have any bad experiences. It was too narrow and too confining in that the teaching still was, we're the right way and everybody else is wrong, and I couldn't accept that. And so I stopped going to church. My grandmother had been introduced to Unity, invited me to attend, and over a period of time, as the ideas were making sense to me and helping me with an issue I was facing in my life, I actually started to have visions. I would sit in the church service, and I would see myself on the platform speaking. And that was a very disturbing vision. It frightened me. I didn't fit the stereotype that I had of a minister, which was at least a middle-aged man and someone who knew the Bible and someone who was comfortable speaking. I wasn't a man. I wasn't middle-aged. The only class I ever dropped out of in junior college was speech because I was too afraid to get up and give a 2-minute talk in front of the class. So the visions were disturbing. I pushed them aside. And oftentimes when you resist something and you push it away, it goes into the subconscious, which it did in my case. And I started to have nightmares. I would wake up in the middle of the night with the vision that I was a minister. So I went to my grandmother one afternoon, and I said, I need to talk to you about something that's bothering me. And she said, wait a minute, Wendy, before you say anything else, I need to go get something. She left the room. She came back with an envelope, and in the envelope was a note she had written to herself about me, that she had had a premonition that I was going to be drawn into the ministry.
Ooh.
And yeah.
I just got a chill.
So it was really not something that I sought. I had wanted and felt called to do something that would make a difference in the world, and I thought that that would be either in social work, psychology, or in medicine. But even in my senior year of high school at a relatively young age, I could see that each of those fields separated an individual. One worked with the mind, one worked with the body, and the other worked with life circumstances. You know, this was 30 plus years ago. Now there's an integration of many of those disciplines, but there wasn't in 1974. And so I wasn't pursuing any of those paths. Ministry actually has wound up allowing me to touch many of those same issues and to do it in an integral approach.
Wow. Well, a lot of people in your circumstances might have just turned away and walked away. I mean, walked away from the dreams they were having. So I would give you a big, big credit for following through.
Well, thanks.
That was quite a big leap.
I know. Oh. I mean, it would scare me to death.
Well, there was definitely a lot of fear to overcome, and you know, that's why, you know, I wrote in the book, one of the questions I put in there is faith or fear guiding your decisions. If you're listening to your internal voice of fear, what is it telling you? If you set that voice aside, you don't even have to turn it off. If you just set it aside for a moment and then ask yourself, and now if I were to listen to the voice of faith, what would my decision be? You get a completely different response, and you get a response usually that's one that opens your heart to new possibilities. You still have to deal with the fear, but it can be dealt with.
Now, do you
what was your next step in going toward becoming a minister? I mean, after you saw this in your dreams and then your grandmother, you know, shared her message, I mean, what did you do after that?
Well, I had to get over being angry because I had gone to her convinced that she would say, "Oh, Wendy, this is ridiculous. You're too young. You're a woman. You don't want to do that." I really, that's the reason I went to her, was I figured she would be able to point me in the right direction and tell me why this was absolutely ridiculous. So after I got over being angry that instead of talking me out of it, she said, "You know, honey, I really think this is what you're meant to do." Then it was a matter of researching, well, what does that entail? What's the application process? What's the education process? And going through all those things. And the very interesting thing is that it wasn't until many years later that I realized how easy my path going into ministerial school was compared to the path for many other people. It was just, I guess, really meant to be. The doors opened, and while I had to do all the usual things, it was almost that it was a touch of grace as I moved through, and was, in fact, the youngest one to have entered the seminary and the youngest one to have been ordained. And I give Unity an awful lot of credit that they took the chance that they took with somebody as young as I was. You know, I didn't have the life experience that an older person would have just by living more years than I had lived. But I certainly have it now.
And as you said, there weren't that many women
Well, actually, in Unity there were. Unity has always had a very strong representation of women. It was founded in the late 1800s by a wife and her husband. So that's not where the gender dynamic ever came to play.
Now, is this in your book, the story that you just shared with us? Did you write this in your book?
I actually did, because it was an example I gave of a question I like, which is, what's God preparing me to do? Mm-hmm. And sometimes we misread the circumstances of our lives sometimes. The difficulties we might be in or the problems we might be having may very well be the very evolutionary drivers that are going to help propel us to become the kind of person that our soul is longing to become. But if we're looking with imperfect vision, if you will, then we're only going to see the problem as a problem and an obstacle that we're trying to get past, and not necessarily unpack and discover the true gift that challenge or fear or shortcoming might be representing.
It's similar to the question I always ask myself, is what lesson am I learning from this?
Mm-hmm.
But your question goes even deeper.
That question is a very good one, though, that you pose. You know, what am I learning from this? A lot of times people will take the wrong lesson forward from a difficult time in their lives, maybe a health challenge or a betrayal in a relationship or a failed business or a divorce. They may take just the pain from the relationship or from that circumstance forward. And that doesn't help us. Every situation that we make it through, however we make it through, has the potential to make us stronger and to become a true blessing in our lives if we mine it for the gold, if we're willing, once we get through it, or even while we're going through it, to ask ourselves, what can I be learning here? Here's a powerful question. What is this situation telling me about myself? Or what in me, here's another question in the book, what in me is allowing this circumstance or allowing this treatment or allowing this situation to remain in my life? These are very deep self-reflective questions, but when we ask them not from a place of punishing ourselves or feeling guilty or ashamed, but if we ask them rather from a place of genuine curiosity, we will get answers that will be very important to us, that will help us mine the gold in that situation so that we not only move through it, but we can begin to create a different life for ourselves.
Well, that gives us the feeling that we actually do have the power in our lives. I mean, it's just not by random. We do have power to be able to change our lives. And those questions to me, as you're asking them or giving them as examples, actually tells me, well, I have the power to change my life.
Right, you do. We all do. We all do. That's one of the first steps of, or phases of awakening in spiritually, actually. Most of us start from a place of life is happening to us. And that's a place of real victimhood. If things are not good, it's a place of real victimhood. We think life is happening to us. The real, and perhaps one of the most dramatic steps in our awakening spiritually, is this first stage or this first step where we move out of the belief that life is happening to us and we're merely an observer or a bystander and that we're powerless, to moving into the awareness that, no, life is not happening to me. Life is happening through me. And when we get to the place where we are living from the awareness of by me rather than to me, we begin to reclaim the power that's always been ours, but that we either didn't know we had or that we turned our backs on or we didn't know how to use.
That's very powerful.
Yes. Wendy, your book is also filled with quotes from well-known people. What are some of your favorite quotes?
Oh, gosh. You know, that was one of the most fun parts of writing the book, actually. I wanted the book to be visually appealing. And so when you open the book, there's the usual text. But sprinkled throughout the book on either side of the page, there's often a quotation that just underscores whatever the question or whatever the story is that I'm sharing. And so, I don't know, there may be 50 or 60 of them sprinkled throughout the book. And actually, I love them all. I had a hard time paring them down to that. But a few of my favorites, one is from Joseph Campbell. I love this quote. "We must let go of the size of the life that we have planned so as to accept the one that is waiting for us."
Whoa.
We must let go of the life that we've planned so as to accept the one that is waiting for us. I think that's just a powerful, powerful quotation. In fact, if we've got the time, I'd love to read just a bit of a story to you from the book that relates to that point. Do we have the time?
Yes, we sure do.
Okay, let me see if I can find it. I had to go grab the book. It's actually a story that, here it is. "I once read that when New York City was first established, it had a total of 5 or 6 streets. The city fathers knew that the easiest way to name the streets was to simply number them. They had already decided that the final street within the city limits would be called Boundary Street. In order to determine which street would eventually become Boundary Street, the city fathers speculated as to just how big New York City was likely to become. They then expanded that number sufficiently to give the city plenty of room to grow. They felt sure that the city would never grow beyond 19 streets, so 19th Street became Boundary Street and the city's limit. New York City now has 254 streets, 235 more than the city fathers ever thought possible. Where have you set your 19th street? The question, am I willing to let go of the size of the life I've known to have a bigger life, can catapult us to a whole new dimension of being." Isn't that a fascinating story?
Oh, yeah.
I have chills.
Perfect example.
Marvelous.
Yeah, and that's very much what I think Joseph Campbell is saying there, that we have to let go of the size of the life that we've planned so we can accept the one that's really waiting for us. Oftentimes, we are our own worst enemy. We limit ourselves, and we need to think bigger, you know?
You are a perfect example of that.
Well, I don't know about the word perfect, but I'm certainly an example of it in part. You know, Sir Edmund Hillary, who was the first person to climb out Mount Everest, made the statement, "It's not the mountain we conquer, but ourselves." You know, I think we need to set big dreams and big goals for ourselves, not just because we might achieve them, but because of who we have to become to achieve them. And that's something that no one can ever take away from you. The growth and the development that you experience of your own volition in order to try to accomplish your dream, your vision, your goal is a precious investment in yourself. And no one and nothing can ever take that away from you.
And I don't believe that you're ever too old to think that way.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you.
Wendy, in doing your book, whether it was in preparation or after you did it, or hindsight, whatever, what was the most difficult thing that you had to do in the book?
In the actual writing of the book?
Yes, uh-huh.
What was the most difficult?
Or in preparing. It didn't have to be the writing.
Actually, just making the time to do it. My ministry is a large ministry, and I am not only the spiritual director of it, but I also serve as a CEO. I serve on a few boards. I do quite a bit of traveling. I just have a lot of responsibility. And I had been asked for at least 15 years, would you please write a book? And I kept putting it off. I kept putting it off because I just didn't feel I could make the time to do it. And so that was the most difficult part, was actually committing and saying, I'm going to do what it takes to get this done. And I did. I've since learned that there's a lot more to the book world than just writing and having the book published. There's doing interviews such as this and doing book tours and all those kinds of things. So for me, usually the biggest challenge I'm facing is I have so many wonderful opportunities that are presented to me that I want to say yes to, and for me, it's almost always how do I make the time for that?
That's a big one.
Do you use your own questions?
I do, and some of them get me in trouble, and I say that tongue in cheek. I think my favorite question in the book, I have a love-hate relationship with this question. It's, if you could solve the how, what would you do? And it's a question that that I've used in boardrooms in my own ministry as we've faced some big opportunities that also had some challenges associated with them. I would teach to this concept that you have to separate problem solving from decision making. And a person, when they're faced with with two different opportunities or just one big opportunity, has got to be able to separate solving the problems or challenges within that opportunity from the decision to pursue that opportunity. And so I'll give you two quick examples here. I've already said I've used it in our ministry, but I also used it in the decision to become a mother. I became a mother rather late. I had my first child at 35 and my second at 40. And part of the reason for that was my husband and I were very, and still are, very deeply committed to this spiritual community and the many other things that we do associated with it, that I just couldn't imagine how I would juggle being a mother and the kind of mother I would be committed to being and still pursue the work that I know is mine to do in the world. And as I was deeply contemplating that question, which was the wrong question, I was reminded of this bigger question. If I could solve the how, what would I do? If I could solve how I would manage the extra work, what would my decision be? In an instant, I knew, my heart knew, your heart usually does know, my heart knew that for me, the richness and wonder and beauty of being a mom would be something that I would want to experience. And the minute I got in touch with that, I was actually on a walk. I came home from my morning walk and said to my husband, guess what? And, you know, and we made the decision together then to become parents. And did we have to solve the problems of how? Sure we did. But what happens when we separate problem solving from decision making and we make the decision based on what's really ours to do, what we really deeply feel guided to say yes to, a holy yes, when we identify what that is, then we stop vacillating back and forth, getting stuck in the how. When we can say yes to the what, and we're no longer vacillating with the what, then we can free up all that energy that was spent going back and forth and back and forth into solving the problem. Does that make sense?
Boy, that's good. That's really good.
That kind of leads me to my next question. And using your book, How does a person choose the right question?
Well, I don't know. How does a person choose the right question? I think it depends upon the circumstances that you're in or what you're wanting to work toward or what you're wanting to improve. And maybe a better answer I could give has to do with how to approach the material in the book. There are people who like to read a book from the beginning to the end. And this book certainly can be approached that way. Start with chapter one and go all the way to the end of the book. That's one way. Another way would be to look at the chapter headings and to ask yourself, well, what's the area? What jumps out at me? Where's my interest? There's a chapter in there on increasing your inner genius. There's a chapter on relationships. There's a chapter on spiritual growth. There's a chapter on personal growth. There's a chapter on knowing yourself. So an individual might sit down and just look at the chapter headings and just be open to which one jumps off the page as being of greatest interest. Another way to approach it is to actually get together with a couple of friends. And one of the neat things about working with material like this in a circle of friends or even with your spouse or with your family is you will get to know yourself and each other much more than you already do.
Let me ask you a question here. When you were doing your book, what was the biggest surprise that came out of the book?
Let me think for a moment.
Or perhaps something that brought you happiness that beyond anything that you thought would be there.
I liked your question. That I actually got to work on this book with my son. My son is now a freshman at the University of California at Berkeley. And by the way, my husband and I homeschooled him and are still homeschooling our daughter in the midst of everything else that we're doing because of, again, separating problem solving from decision making. But in the initial putting together of the book, Jonathan transcribed all of my messages. I had actually given these first as talks that I had designed to eventually become this book. But you can't take just a transcribed lecture and make a book out of it. You still have to do quite a bit of work. So he helped me with that. And it was a great joy to bounce ideas off of him, to completely restructure the book, and to have part of it done with a collaborative spirit, and to witness his sense of self-esteem at having been asked at such a young age to participate in something as significant as helping bring forth a book. He's a brilliant student and a great writer, so the fact that he happened to be only 17 at the time that I asked him was immaterial. So that was probably one of the most joyful things. And then I think the last would be the day the book came out. My husband made colored copies of the cover of the book and had 20 or 30 of them plastered all over his side of the mirror in our master bathroom. And I walked upstairs and saw it, and I just thought, oh, how sweet and how tender and special. Those were two more personal but very delightful things that happened with regard to bringing forth the book.
Thank you for sharing that.
Now, you mentioned people using the book together. Would this be a book that groups of people could get together and actually use?
Absolutely. In fact, I had written it specifically with that in mind. I wrote it for a very broad audience, and even though there's definitely a spiritual flavor and tone to it, it could be used and enjoyed by virtually anybody. But because I'm also very connected to the unity and religious science spiritual paths and to the thousands of ministers in the country, I wrote it as with 7 chapters that could be used either as a 7-week series in a spiritual community, but also could be used as a series in book clubs. And so on my website, there is not only the free download of chapter one, the introduction in chapter one, but there is also a free study guide and facilitator's guide. So if somebody wanted to, if you wanted to get together with a couple of your friends, regardless of whether you're part of any spiritual community or not, you could get a copy of the book and download the study guide and be able to work it together in a fun and easy way.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for sharing that, and thinking ahead and having that actually on your website is wonderful.
Yeah.
So Oprah likes to talk about the one thing. What is that one thing you know for sure about this book?
Well, I think I would have to say that the questions that the reader will find on the pages of this book, with the stories and the quotations, will lead the reader to discovering entirely unique answers within themselves that will absolutely guide them into a life of greater love and joy and true fulfillment.
Were you interviewed by Oprah?
Not yet.
Oh, well, let's put that into the ethers.
I believe that that may very well happen. She is a she reads the Unity's little magazine, Daily Word, every day. In fact, she had a picture of the Daily Word magazine in her, I think it was her July issue. And my book is featured in the November-December issue of Daily Word. So she's very likely to see my face and the book right there. And then my marketing and public relations person is pursuing that as a path.
Do you have any other books on the horizon?
I do, actually. And just playing with the idea of collecting some of the answers that people and stories that people share as a result of using this book. And so we already have a mechanism in place. There are lots of study groups that are starting to use the material this month, and some that are going to be doing it at the start of the new year. And so we're in communication with these groups to invite them to share their best answers and stories. For example, there's a couple who are in their, probably late 50s, that have decided that they would be open to legally adopting their granddaughter. There's some challenges in the family dynamic, and the granddaughter might have been put up for adoption. And though this couple are older and the wife has never had children and this would be a huge adjustment, she shared with me that the question, if she could solve the how, what would she do, was what caused her and her husband to say without question they would adopt this child, their grandchild. And so there's stories like that where people can just see the value in asking really good questions. So the next book will likely be a compilation of those, with me interspersing stories and teaching elements. And then I'm playing with another one as a possibility that might be something like, now tell yourself that. And it would be some stories related to that.
You have podcast from your Sunday, is it sermons or?
I do. On our Unity Center website, and that is www.theunitycenter.net. I have podcasts of the messages I give on Sunday morning, and that's on a nominal subscription basis. So those are not free. There's a small charge, and I don't know what that is. But I also do have something that your listeners might be interested in that's free. I call them Mindful Moments, and these are delightful short stories. They're all under 1 minute long, and it's me telling a story and giving a teaching point. And those are free. They're downloadable from the Unity Center website, and they can also be forwarded to anybody. So the stories are just charming, delightful. They're a great little spiritual pick-me-up and with a little teaching point. So those are the Mindful Moments, that are on the Unity Center website.
Okay. And so the website is unitycenter.com?
No. It's theunitycenter.net. And
okay.
Then my website is my name, wendycraigpurcell.com. They link to one another, so if a person finds one, they'll be able to find the other.
Okay.
We will be putting your website up on ours,
too. Oh, thank
too.
You.
Mm-hmm.
So through your travels, you've been probably traveling quite putting for book tours, right?
I'm only doing a little bit of traveling around the book right now. Basically, what I'm doing is wherever I already have travel plans, my marketing person is talking to bookstores and radio and television stations in that area saying I'm available. I am accepting on a limited basis speaking engagements. I'm going to be in New York City in February next year giving a talk and then also doing a book signing at the very large Barnes & Noble in Lincoln Center. So my ministry and my personal commitments as a mom still play a very high demand on my time and attention. But
are you going to be in Santa Cruz?
I am. In fact,
October?
Yes. I'm going to be speaking for an event, a fundraising event for the Institute of Heart Math. They have a big, great kickoff event that's happening Thursday evening, October 22nd, and I'll be there participating in that, and then I'll actually be presenting Saturday morning, October 24th. I'll be speaking on practical spirituality.
Oh, great.
Well, our listeners are from that area, so we'll remind them what a great event this is.
It is going to be a great event.
There's some really great speakers. Greg Braden, I don't know if he's going to be there for the weekend, but I know he's going to be there Thursday.
Yes, I know Greg well. People will not want to miss him. And Marcy Shymoff will be there, and Howard Martin will be there. It'll be a wonderful, wonderful event and a great cause.
Wendy, we have a few minutes left. Is there anything that we have not been able to touch upon that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Just how they can get the book. It is available right now on Amazon.com, and they can order it there. If they read it and enjoy it, I'd love to ask them to post a positive comment on it, give a short review on Amazon.com. Would love to invite them to check out my website, www.wendycraigpurcell.com. They can also check out the Unity Center website, www.theunitycenter.net. And they can follow me on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on MySpace. That's a way to get plugged in. We've got a big event coming up here at the Unity Center on Thursday evening, November 5th. Your listeners may be familiar with Michael Bernard Beckwith. He's a dear friend and colleague of mine. He's been on Oprah numerous times and on Larry King Live. He's going to be making a guest appearance here at the Unity Center on Thursday evening, November 5th, and people can get more information and tickets on the Unity Center website. And they can also pay attention to the PBS stations, that some of which are airing the program that Deepak and I did on the Third Jesus.
Oh, that's going to be a great series. And I want to remind people in the Santa Cruz area that they can find out about the event happening on the 22nd and the weekend of the 24th through Gateway Bookstore. So we're so lucky to have you and the other great speakers to be in our area. And be sure to, can people order the book? I know they can order it on Amazon, but do they order it through Unity also?
Yes, they can also get it off our website, the Unity Center website. They can get it off the Wendy Craig Purcell website, and they can get it directly from unity.org.
Well, we had a wonderful hour with you, and we want to thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Is there one last thing you want to say to our listeners before we go?
Keep asking good questions.
How did I know you were going to say that?
Because you're very smart.
The book is Ask Yourself This.
That's right.
That's the name of the book that we must have in our back pocket for a tool.
Oh, yes. That sounds good, Paula. Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you, Taz. My pleasure.
And if anybody wants to get information from our website, we have Wendy's information up on our website, the TazandPaulaShow.com. And have a great week, and thank you for taking time out of your busy, busy schedule to be with us.
My pleasure. You take care.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.